From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we'll learn about the creation of the Harmony Test, a non-invasive prenatal test for birth defects. Then as the Milwaukee Ballet prepares to open Ballet Russe Reimagined, we learn the century-old Milwaukee connection to that Russian company.
The Ballet Russe was around 1912, and then there was a slight break and the Ballet Russe reformed after that, which is when it eventually came to America. In fact, the Ballet Russe that came to America ended up performing at the Pabst Theatre, where we're going to be performing. And there's a picture there on one of the walls.
And we learn about Milwaukee singer-songwriter John Seeger's conversations on songs.
You know, it's dangerous to talk about songs, but I've been thinking and talking about them forever, and they're still mysterious. You never solve that mystery of why people understand it instantly.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Bonnie North. Pregnancy can be incredibly difficult. Sometimes the hardest part is not knowing what's really happening to the fetus inside and whether or not it's developing into a healthy human being. When Dr. Aoi Tomita Mitchell was pregnant, she was faced with a serious dilemma that could have risked the health and safety of her fetus. She and her husband, Dr. Michael Mitchell, took their problem and created a solution, the Harmony Test. Both Drs. Mitchell sat down with Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about their work.
The Harmony Test is a test that is given or performed on pregnant mothers as a non-invasive way to look for problems with the fetus, particularly genetic problems with the fetus. Specifically, it looks for trisomy 21.
Now, when I talked to you about this, you said part of the reason you developed the test, you had your own difficulties during your pregnancy.
Yes. This test was developed out of a personal need. And
would you like me to tell that story?
Yes.
Go ahead. When Aoi was pregnant with one of our children, she underwent a test which was commonly performed at that point to look for problems with the baby. And she tested into a very high risk category for having a genetic problem. And it was compelling to the clinicians that were taking care of her. And we lived in Kentucky at the time. And they brought her to the amniocentesis suite, where an amniocentesis is a, as many people would know, is a way that you can make a definitive diagnosis for a problem with the fetus by placing a needle into the womb and aspirating some cells related to the fetus and then doing a genetic assessment of that. The problem with that is that it's associated with the risk of fetal loss, and we certainly did not want to lose our baby, and we were not going to terminate if there was a problem. But in Kentucky, in order to get the services that you need, if you were to have a problem, you did need to have a definitive diagnosis. The other issue for us was that we knew that there was a problem with the surveillance test that was available at the time, that it had a really challenging or poor sensitivity and specificity, that in the situation where you could get a result and it could lead you to need amniocentesis but not really be indicative that you had a problem. And so we decided not to undergo amniocentesis because of the risk of fetal loss. And then the risk of fetal loss was about 1 in 200, which is about the same as the risk of mortality with a heart surgery on a baby. And so knowing that, we just didn't want to take that risk. And so Aoi spent the rest of her pregnancy thinking about this problem. She had a background in genetics and genetic research, and she came up with a really ingenious solution whereby you could take a sample of blood from the mother and look at something that is called cell-free DNA, which is basically fragments of DNA that are circulating in the mother's plasma, and then you can actually see the component that's from the fetus and analyze it. And using that technique, she thought that this would be a way that you could make a diagnosis definitively. So she developed that idea, and we together applied for a grant from the Wallace Coulter Foundation, which likes to see collaboration between clinician and scientists. And we got enough money from that grant to start and develop this concept and start a small clinical study, which we performed up here when we were recruited to Children's Hospital and to the Medical College.
Mike was incredibly supportive during this time. It was hard not to want to have the amniocentesis, but he was extremely positive and encouraging. And actually, my graduate work had been in human genetic research and specifically in rare variant analysis. So it made this particular scientific challenge relatively straightforward. It just kind of all came together when there was an opportunity to apply for grant funding to work together and to try to solve this challenge together.
I would be remiss if I didn't ask, was your child all right?
Thank you.
Yeah, no, yes, our child ended up being not having the genetic problem that was suspected that she would have, and just sort of cementing our commitment to seeing if we could develop this so that other women and families would be assisted with this. So we did launch the clinical study here, and it worked really well. And as a consequence of that, we committed to trying to bring this to the general population and recognize that through a process of stumbling, figured out that the way to do that was actually to create a company and raise money, and that was the way in which you could actually get this to people. And so we did that.
How widely available is this test?
The test is very widely available and performed regularly. I think that it's approaching replacing that serum test that I had taken, which had given us the false positive. So we are thrilled about that.
You know, you mentioned you took a serum test. What makes the Harmony test more accurate?
So the serum test was really based off of hormone levels in the serum, whereas the Harmony test is based off of, Mike was describing, cell-free DNA that's present and circulating in the maternal bloodstream.
And hormones would be less reflective of what's happening with the fetus?
Yes, there's a lot of variability with that, and much of the, I think, references were set against population that may have looked different than myself, whereas a DNA-based test could be very quantitative. You could really assess the fetal genetics that would be present, the mother's blood.
So how is the test used? Who are the likely candidates of people who would take the Harmony test?
A mother who's expecting, a woman who might be expecting. Initially, it was targeted to high-risk pregnancies. At the time, I was considered a high-risk pregnancy because I was, I believe, 34, 35 at the time, so at advanced maternal age, which
doesn't seem very old.
No, not anymore. But now I think it's becoming more widely used.
So you've also developed another test more recently. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Sure. I'm a pediatric heart surgeon at Children's Hospital. And what I do is operate on children with congenital heart defects, so defects of the heart that they're born with, anatomic malarrangements. And this congenital heart disease is the most common form of defects. It affects about 1% of live births. It's also the birth defect that's associated with the highest mortality. So it's the number one cause of infant-related mortality that's associated with a birth defect is congenital heart disease. Fortunately, these days, the vast majority of patients that are born with congenital heart disease are effectively treated with surgery. There's been a lot of development in our field, which has pushed it to the point where there's probably somewhere between a 2 to 5% mortality of all comers. So that means that in general, patients do really well. However, the patients with the most severe variants of congenital heart disease can go on to, despite successful surgery, can go on to really fail from progressive heart failure. And the last solution for these patients in that situation is heart transplantation. And heart transplantation is used both in pediatrics and in adult patients who have heart failure in this country. And the number of patients that are requiring that and are able to get it is actually, fortunately, on the treatment end, is increasing. So there's about 3,500 heart transplants that are performed in the U.S. per year in 2019, and about 520 or so were done in pediatric patients. That is only possible because of the generosity and the sort of the foresight of all of us who live in the United States and think about donating organs for this kind of medical use. And as such, all these donated hearts are extremely precious, very precious resource that needs to be preserved. So it's really an amazing technology because a patient who's near death can literally undergo this operation and then within a week be up and around and recover to near normalcy. And it's just it's really beautiful to see that kind of success. What we have to do is preserve the health of those organs. And what plagues that treatment is that they can succumb to rejection. And rejection takes a number of different forms. We talk about cellular rejection, antibody-mediated rejection, acute rejection, and chronic rejection. And we have to monitor for the rejection. And when we detect it, we can treat it with steroids or increasing the doses of different immunosuppressive therapies. And the way we monitor rejection today is by taking patients to the catheterization laboratory where we place a needle in the vein and pass the catheter up into the heart and actually do a cardiac biopsy, or we call it an endomyocardial biopsy, where basically jaws come out of the catheter and take a small piece of the myocardium and it's pulled out. And then we look at it under the microscope and look at to see if there's inflammation and then grade the inflammation and also determine if it's an antibody-mediated rejection or if it's a cellular-mediated rejection and then give appropriate therapy based on that assessment. The problem is that that's an invasive test, and it particularly if you're a child, that's a very intimidating thing to undergo. But for any of us, I think having that procedure done is significant. More than that, it can be dangerous because in some cases, we inadvertently biopsy the valves, the tricuspid valve, or you create an injury to the myocardium that results in fluid or blood coming out around the heart. And in the worst case scenario, that can actually be life-threatening. There are other issues. The rejection, when it occurs, it can occur as a patchy process. So it's possible that you can be having rejection and the site of which you sample the heart is not the site where the rejection is occurring. And so you can miss active rejection. And so you can get what's called a false negative from that. Finally, there's a problem with what we call inter-observer variability, which means that one pathologist, despite excellent training and skill, can look at the specimen and make a different call than another pathologist. And so this has been studied and reported, and it's a fundamental limitation of the biopsy read and that technology. So all those things together make it compelling. It's really an important goal, almost the holy grail of the field of rejection surveillance, to come up with a non-invasive test that would be accurate for the detection of rejection so that you wouldn't have to undergo the biopsy and you could use the test as surveillance and really pick this up early.
So how do you skirt around, you know, really getting a tissue sample? Because when you're talking about it, it seems like, well, wouldn't that be the most direct way of you know, finding out if something's wrong? But as you mentioned, there are a lot of issues with both doing the procedure, but also analyzing what you get. So how do you avoid that?
So the idea came because I had a particular patient of mine who had had a very complex form of congenital heart disease and had a successful operation to repair that in the sense that they survived the surgery and went home. But over time, their heart failed, and we thought she would need a transplantation. But at that point, she had no more vascular access, so she couldn't undergo that kind of biopsy and surveillance. So we had the idea, getting directly to your question, that perhaps if we could look at the DNA from the donor heart that was circulating in her serum, in her plasma as a recipient of the heart, just like we could see the fetal DNA circulating in a mother, and if we quantified that amount of DNA, that perhaps the amount of DNA would indicate injury to the donor organ and that would be an indicator of rejection. And her hope was that, geez, in her case, if we had this test, then she could be listed for heart transplant. But as it stood, she couldn't be listed because she didn't have vascular access. So there would be no option for her. So that was the case that really inspired us to try it out. And that was the idea. And we did the pilot study and were really pleased to see that it worked in a a group of about 80 patients, 80 children. That was published in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology and allowed us to get subsequent funding from the NIH. We were awarded $3.3 million from the NIH and NHLBI to pursue this at 8 centers in a much larger multi-center study.
Now, I don't know if you can answer this question because I know there's a level of patient privacy that you have to observe, but was your patient all right in the end?
Yes. Actually, she's phenomenal and amazingly has recovered to the point where she doesn't need a heart transplant. And she's just a beautiful, really intelligent, thriving girl now. But there are many others just like her who actually have needed heart transplant and many who have undergone that successfully and a few who have now used this test to actually help them with the monitoring.
So in some ways, it sounds like this test shares similarities with the Harmony test in that it's finding, you know, this, I'm going to screw this up because I don't quite understand DNA on this level, but finding these little pieces of DNA inside of their blood plasma. How does that work exactly?
So the cell-free DNA component is much harder to quantify because it's about more than a thousand-fold less than what you typically expect from a simple blood draw where you're obtaining DNA. So that's the challenge. And then when we're just talking about very small percentages or even less than that and trying to quantify the non-cell-free DNA, that really becomes a technical challenge. And so that's really takes a tremendous team to be able to do that accurately and reproducibly.
Now, this is something that you've developed for people who are getting heart transplants, but is it something that could also work for other organ transplants or even other limb transplants? I know some people get arms or legs.
That's a
great question. And we're studying that in lung transplants currently, and we're seeing that it seems to work very well. And in theory, it could apply to all solid organ transplants, potentially even have use in bone marrow transplantation.
So what's next for you? I know you're still doing some studies, of course.
Yes. Well, we were extremely fortunate to have had this tremendous research opportunity to work and understand how cell-free DNA works. The medical college has been just a wonderfully supportive partner in trying to bring this technology back to the patients. And so in order to do that, that did require, just as we had done with the prenatal effort, required us forming an entity. So that endeavor, it's an entity in Milwaukee. It's called TIE Diagnostics, which stands for Transplant and Immunology. And it's here in the Milwaukee County Research Park. And we have built out a molecular diagnostics reference lab, which we've been very fortunate that Milwaukee has the talent, and we've been able to attract the talent to try to make this technology available.
And I'll add I think it's broadly applicable, and that's very exciting to us. However, it came out of this really profound clinical need in a particular child, and is so important for in the field of pediatric heart transplantation, and working with the Herma Heart Institute, which is where I work, and program that really champions the ideas behind taking innovations in medical care and then figuring out how we can actually apply them to the care of children is what drives us. So we're hopeful that this will make a meaningful difference to the kids right here in Milwaukee who need heart transplant and then branch out from there.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Mitchell, thank you both so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Joy.
Dr. Aoi Tomita Mitchell is a professor of surgery and biomedical engineering at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Dr. Michael Mitchell is a pediatric cardiothoracic surgeon at the Herma Heart Institute at Children's Hospital of Wisconsin. Together, they share a laboratory in the Children's Research Institute, and they have founded two biotechnology startup companies, including TAI Diagnostics here, based in Milwaukee. They spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers, and you can find out more of our conversations with doctors from the Medical College of Wisconsin at WUWM.com. Coming up after a break, we'll talk with one of the Milwaukee Ballet choreographers about their upcoming production of Ballet Russe Reimagined. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. When Igor Stravinsky's ballet The Rite of Spring premiered in Paris in 1913, the audience rioted. The music was angular and dissonant, and the dance ritualistic and based on pagan myths. A century later, Stravinsky's orchestral score is considered one of the most influential classical works of the 20th century, and the ballet has been restaged innumerable times in more than 60 countries across five continents. But it all began with the Ballet Russe, Sergei Diaghilev, Vaslav Nijinsky, and, of course, Stravinsky. Beginning this evening at the Pabst Theater, Milwaukee ballet choreographers Garrett Glassman, Timothy O'Donnell, and Nicole Teague Howell will present reimaginings of three of the most iconic works from the Ballet Russe, all set to the music of Stravinsky, The Firebird, Les Noces, and The Rite of Spring. Timothy O'Donnell joins me in the studio now to tell us more.
Firstly, I think it's such a fitting program for Milwaukee Ballet. In the Michael Pink's time alone, we've created 50 original works for the company, which is extraordinary. And that's also really part of the heart and spirit of what the Ballet Russe was all about, just creativity and energy. So for this production, myself, Garrett Glassman, and Nicole Teague Howell have taken an original Ballet Russe piece, and we've tried to reimagine it and create something new from that original work.
So the Ballet Russe was when, in the 1860s?
No, the Ballet Russe was around 1912.
Oh, really?
And
okay.
Pre-war. And then there was a slight break, and the Ballet Russe reformed after that, which is when it eventually came to America. In fact, the Ballet Russe that came to America ended up performing at the Pabst Theater, where we're going to be performing, which is like really, really exciting. There's a picture there on one of the walls.
Of the company in that
performing,
time.
Yeah.
Wow. So did the Ballet Russe launch the careers of famous people like Nureyev and that, or is that a different?
Different time. Nureyev was much later. So Nijinsky, who's one of the main characters in my actual reimagining of The Rite of Spring, was probably the most famous dancer to come from the Ballet Russe. But there are countless, and not just dancers, Stravinsky, Picasso. What was amazing about Sergei Diaghilev, who was sort of the, I'm not going to call him the company manager, he ran the Ballet Russe, not from an artistic standpoint, but he collected these phenomenal artists in the world and brought them into this one place where together there was this hub of creativity. So it wasn't just about the dance. It was art in general was being generated through this Ballet Russe.
So was this the famous Rite of Spring that everyone rioted?
This is the very same.
The very same one. Do you know why they rioted?
Yes, for the most part, it was a response to the music more so than the dance. Stravinsky's score, which is now looked at as being one of the most extraordinary of the 20th century, at the time, it divided the audience. So the riot wasn't just everybody hating it. It was actually the love and hate and the extreme emotion that went with hearing that music for the first time that caused the uproar.
So hopefully we won't have the same kind of response at the...
No, hopefully. I do actually start my piece with the sound of a riot, though.
Do you?
Yes, I do, because I thought the theater-going crowd and especially the orchestra crowd will probably get a, not that my piece is funny, but they'll probably get a laugh out of it.
And they'll
because
understand
they know.
It.
They know exactly.
They'll get that.
It's a tipping of the hat to the history of, you know, the piece itself.
So when you and your other choreographers look at these iconic, what are now iconic ballets, and try to reimagine them, you know, how do you approach that? Do you look at it as I want to bounce off it completely and do something different? You know, what is your process?
There are so many different ways, and all three of us, and I love this, just went in entirely different directions. I don't want to speak too much about their work without them here. I can tell you a little bit about it, but myself, I started looking at the Rite of Spring and, of course, started studying the Rite of Spring and the history of it, and then I thought, wow, that's a really interesting story. So I was going to do a Rite of Spring about the making of the Rite of Spring, which then evolved to me making a work about the Ballet Russe and the amazing people who worked there and all the drama attached to that. Garrett's taking Lenos and he's putting it to the music of Puccinella. And what's interesting, Lenos was just a Russian folktale about a wedding. There wasn't really much story. And Garrett started thinking more and more deeply about it and then thought it would be amusing and clever to do the night before a wedding, a bachelor party with the men. And it's become such an amazing work. It's so fun to watch. And Nicole has like taken a relook at the relationships between the people in the Firebird and who they actually are. And she's really explored movement in her work, which I think is great. So the show as a whole just sort of covers whatever you like in dance is sort of in this show because the three of us have just gone in totally different directions.
Right, yet still having those original pieces as your touchstones.
Oh, 100%. And Garrett's is probably the most abstracted in his, and that's because his the piece he was rethinking was just a wedding.
Like a set piece or something.
It was just so, it was an abstract piece even for the day that it was choreographed. So, however, he's taken that theme of how it was being looked at then and wanted to see how we look at it now and what that's become in the 100 years since the Ballet Russe did this work and how we think about it, which I think is, I mean, when he first told me that, I was jealous at how genius that was.
But you have a really good one too. As you were studying it and thinking about how you wanted to create your own work, what did you learn about the Rite of Spring that you didn't know before?
Firstly, it was put off for a while. Stravinsky himself kept putting this idea forward to Diaghilev. He had this idea for this piece of music, and Diaghilev kept putting it off and saying, no, next year. And that went on for a few years. Secondly, it was written in a tiny cabin through the winter, you know, a single room with a piano and a bed and a chair, which visually was also something I wanted to include in my ballet because I thought that was such a great visual, but it didn't make it in the end. Beyond that and the rioting, It's pretty much as far into the Rite of Spring as I actually went. I do know Stravinsky was not particularly happy with Nijinsky's use of the music and didn't think that Nijinsky understood the music the way it was written. And as that came out, nobody seemed to understand the music the way it was written for a very long time, if we even do today.
I know. It is, you know, Stravinsky is more or less mainstream now in classical music, but you listen to that stuff and it's like, wow. Mm. He was going to some really interesting places. Are you using the score?
The score in its complete form and sequentially how it was written as well.
Okay.
Because funnily enough, because in the score, each movement is named. You know, there's the adoration and all of those things. And it's so funny how that's also almost how the sequence of my ballet has worked in as far as the retelling of the story. You know, just like each scene seems to somehow relate to this original organization of the music and the original naming, but telling a completely different story.
Yeah.
Because once again, the Rite of Spring didn't have that much of a story. Find a young girl, sacrifice a young girl, we're going to get crops. Do you know? I mean,
when you sum honestly, it up like
yeah,
that.
There was more to it than that, but it was.
But not a lot.
Yeah, it was 18 minutes of, okay, when is she going to die? Because, you know, but
we
now
know what's happening. We know what's going to come. Yeah.
Whereas I've used every single piece of the music to tell a different scene and to push this narrative forward, which was much easier. I didn't have to come up with a narrative because it's historical, you know.
Right. And there wasn't much narrative to begin with that you had to push against.
Exactly.
Yeah, I had the pleasure of seeing a dress rehearsal at the Royal Ballet in London of somebody's version. Mm-hmm. I forget whose version of The Rite of Spring, but I had never, with the orchestra, I mean, everybody.
I'm not sure who the Royal Ballet is. I know English National just did it last year as well.
Oh, this was probably almost a decade ago.
Okay.
So I honestly don't remember, but I do remember thinking, ooh, this is really fun. Mm-hmm. I didn't love the production, but I was reminded about how the music is just so astonishing.
It really
is. And the kind of movement that you can do to that.
And that's what's so beautiful, because I was thinking about this in terms of choreographing my own work. The Ballet Russe, when you think about reimagining, they had already reimagined. That's what they did. So it's not like we're going in and have to create abstract new movement, because that's not really what we're doing here. We're retelling and we're reimagining, not to be too on the nose about it, but yeah, we're reimagining these stories, because the Ballet Russe themselves were reimagining dance at the beginning of the last century. So the fact that we're just doing that again is more of a tribute to their history than it is about pushing dance forward necessarily.
Right. They were the sort of the pioneers in modern, you know, what we think of as like the really avant-garde now, that's what they were.
And a lot of their work would still be avant-garde
now
today, based on like what people are doing. It's they were really, I've heard these wonderful stories that there are scenes where it was kind of like, pick your story. So there might be a section where all the girls had to spin in a circle around the stage, and just on the night, maybe there'd be four girls doing it, or maybe 20 of them would be like, that would be fun to do tonight. And they'd just go on stage and do that section. Like, there was just this liberation and freedom in the work.
Sort of an anarchy, too.
Exactly, yeah. Which we don't even necessarily see anywhere today. Yeah, no.
But you saw that in all of what was going on just before the First World War, and then after, mm-hmm. too, because, of course, that was just such a cataclysmic thing. But you look, and particularly in Russia, like the set designs that were coming out of the teens and into the 20s, they would be, as you said, they would be completely avant-garde today. People would be like, I don't even know what I'm looking at.
I know. And when we think about names like Picasso, who did so many of their sets, I mean, most of that stuff was also just trashed. So we think about, you know, we think about these other paintings that he did, even his samples, which sell for so much nowadays, but he was doing enormous large-scale sets for the Ballet Russe, and
wouldn't that be amazing
costumes
to see?
And, oh, yeah. I mean, there's some extraordinary books like with imagery out there that I've actually been looking through. Several at the Pink Zone, costume, and everything, the music. It was just, if I could go back in time, it would definitely be the moment in time I'd want to go back to, at least as an artist. It was just, I'd want to be part of what that was.
Well, it's kind of fun that you're getting to sort of create that now.
Yeah.
Well, Tim, it has been such a pleasure.
It always is.
And
thank you.
Yeah, and best of luck, and hope this goes away soon.
I will be fit as a fiddle by the time the show comes around.
All right, so we will see you at the show.
Yes.
Timothy O'Donnell is one of three choreographers whose reimagining of original work from the Ballet Russe will be performed at the Pabst Theater beginning this evening. There is a link to more information about Ballet Russe Reimagined at WUWM.com. We'll take one last break, and then singer-songwriter John Seeger joins us to perform and talk about his new concert series, Seeger on Songs, Conversations. Lake Effect returns with that in just a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. We're back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Milwaukee musician John Seeger takes songs seriously. So seriously, in fact, he has a regular column about other people's songs on UrbanMilwaukee.com. And he's been singing and writing his own for decades. Tonight, he's starting a monthly series at the Jazz Gallery that he's calling Seeger on Songs, Conversations. And he joins me in the studio now to tell us more. Hey, John Seeger.
Hi there.
How are you?
I'm good for me.
I know. It's been a while since I've seen you.
I know. It's been a long time.
It has been. And so you've got this really couple of cool projects going on, and I wanted to hear about them
before
I leave town, since I'm going to miss them because I'm leaving town before.
We're flying you back. I'm sending my private jet.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah. I know.
Perfect.
I got that kind of.
You know, I only take blue M&Ms.
Okay, yeah. We'll make sure. We don't want to get that wrong.
Yeah, no. It's in my rider.
I don't want to see you when you get the green ones.
Yeah, no.
I've heard about
it. It's really ugly. It's really ugly. So anyway, how you been? And what
good.
Is this project?
I've been real good. I've been real busy.
Yeah?
You know, with these projects, I have a record coming out shortly, like a month and a half. And it's an acoustic record with my good friend John Parrott, who's he's the master of the Archtop Acoustic. When you have John, you don't need a drummer. Although I put a drummer on a couple tracks, a semi-twang drummer. But his time is impeccable. And then I just have been writing in a different bag lately. And, you know, since I always write on acoustic, I thought I got to do a record like that. So that'll be out. It's going to be called Modern Folk Volume 2.
Is there a volume one?
No.
Okay. Just let people think there is.
That wasn't my idea. I was going to call it volume one, and I talked to Michael Feldman, a guy I've written a lot of songs with, and he said, call it volume two. And I said, okay, I will.
Yeah, I like it.
I do.
I like that a lot.
It's a little bit naughty.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Get all of the straight stuff out in volume one, and now we're getting to the good stuff in volume two.
Yeah.
Very good. Well, it's not just that, though. You're doing the
album? There's an event that I'm planning, and I have to say I'm really being produced by my wife, Lindsay, who's really great at pulling things together. I'm sort of an upfront kind of guy. I think of things, and I hand it off to competent people, and she's one of them. She's the main one, really. And it's going to be called Seegeron Songs Conversations, and it's going to take place the third Thursday of every month at the Jazz Gallery Art Center. Performing Arts Center, or they're working on the name right now, but it's a jazz gallery, and it's, you know, it's an art center. And I'm going to have guests from around town who I respect. We're going to talk about, like, lifting the hood and looking at songs and what influenced you and how they work and, you know, what's a minor chord and, you know, what did
and
you
and when would you use it? And
and why would you use it?
Yeah, I mean, is this a takeoff on your column?
It is based on that because my column is it would be a conflict for me to say anything nasty like a critic, so I don't want to be perceived that way, but I wanted to express all just what I love about songs. So I pick a song every week that I love and one that not necessarily one I'm even familiar with or been moved by or influenced, but when I hear it and it strikes me as a good story. I just did that Norma Tanaga, who died recently, who did Walking My Cat Named Dog, which I barely remembered. And when I listened to it, it was such a treat, you know?
Yeah.
So I get to write about that.
The alchemy of a good song is mm-hmm. one of those things that, I mean, you and I have talked about it over the years that you've come into the studio. I've talked about it with, like, every musician who's come in here and who writes his or her own stuff. And there is something so human about the need to put all of that stuff in a song.
I know. It's crazy. And everyone's different the way they approach it. But, you know, I really for a long time I came at it from the music end until I learned how to write lyrics working with Michael Feldman, who was kind of a savant at it. And it was years ago. But it's a higher language that everyone, except for a few unfortunate souls, receives and understands emotionally. But not everyone can speak it or write it. So that's the difference between a musician and the rest of the people in the world. Everyone understands music. They don't know why they're feeling a certain way, but that's a musician manipulating them in a benign way rather than a naughty way. And so it is a higher language. You know, I firmly believe that. And I also believe in infinite creativity. It's been proven over and over again by some of the beautiful songs I write about. And I've got I got ones that are near the top all the time, like God Only Knows and Girl from Ipanema and a few
Why
others.
Why Girl from Ipanema? That's an interesting choice.
Both of those songs have middle sections that are nuts, and they deliver you back to the original key. But they go way somewhere different in a beautiful way. And somehow, without you even knowing it, you're back where you were. And the melodies, the words, you know, they're just, they're very moving to me, those songs.
So when you think about song construction, what are the elements? For somebody who might not know how a song comes together, mm-hmm. and I know there's lots of approaches yeah. to that, but what are the elements that a musician is working with?
Everyone's working, hopefully, with the same thing. I'd like – the good example is Lennon and McCartney. I think McCartney had absorbed so much music because his dad was a band leader that he was a little more fluent in it. He wasn't necessarily literate. He didn't read music, and I don't know if he does yet. But he understood all these things. And when he broke a rule, he did it knowledgeably and, you know, kind of willfully. And Lennon just would just – he seemed like – he also was a super musical person, but he was completely self-taught, and he didn't grow up like that. But he had a way of breaking rules first and then putting it back together, or just doing the joy of it in his work is especially, you know, he did some crazy things. So I'm not sure how everybody works. You know, you can be like Randy Newman and be completely schooled and have uncles who wrote movie scores and write, I think, profound music. And you can be Muddy Waters and make profound music because you grew up on a plantation in Mississippi. So I try not to draw that line. I admire folk musicians, unschooled musicians, and I really like Burt Bacharach.
Yeah,
another genius.
Yeah, I like them all because they all bring something to it, you know. But we're talking about melody, we're talking about rhythm,
yeah.
we're talking about harmony sometimes, mm-hmm. and yeah. we're also talking about the lyrics.
Those are the four elements for
yeah.
me. Yeah, those are like the four pillars, I think.
The four pillars
of
song.
Is that a religion now?
I think it is, the four pillars of song.
Yeah.
There's your book title.
I'm doing a clinic right now. That actually, it's a return to basics. I do songwriting clinics with small groups. And I did the first week was, believe it or not, harmony. Second week was melody. Third week was rhythm. Last week was lyrics. And the two, I do a six-week thing, so I've gone beyond the four pillars at this point. The two other really important concepts for me are tension and release, which jazz people obsess about, and good writers know how to do it in all four of those areas, and editing. So those things, I think, are the really important things in songwriting.
Yeah.
You have to know that not every single thing you put down the first time is it, and you have to stick with it until it's perfect.
Well, editing is magic for everybody. You know, all art requires an editor.
And it's mercy for the listener, too.
Yes,
because I've sat through, you know, I've seen some writer's nights and things like that where people think a song should have 26 verses that don't make any sense. So,
well, I mean, you know, it's kind of like, well, Dylan did it, so
yeah.
why can't I? Yeah.
That's right. He gets to do it. No one else does. There might be a couple others. A
couple of others.
But he's Leonard Cohen, too, can go on, and I'm okay with that.
Well, yeah. Tell me about the song of yours that we're going to hear that I understand is relatively recent.
Well, because the first session of Conversation, Seagrand Song Conversation, is going to have Holly Habig and David Wake, two married couple, and both artists I really admire. She's a great singer. He's leads De La Buena, the great Latin jazz band. And they're both really good citizens and very concerned with social justice and very aware of those kind of things and reflected in their music too. So the first conversation is going to be about songs that do that. I'm calling them freedom songs. They can be protest songs. They can be topical songs. I haven't written a lot of those, but now I'm writing quite a few because we're working. My next project is going to be working with Semi-Twang on an acoustic record of those kind of songs. So here's one that's going to be on it. It's called It Wasn't Right. 17, he wasn't right. 18, he wasn't right. They shipped him off, it wasn't right. It wasn't right, it wasn't right. Upstairs, he wasn't right. Still a kid, he wasn't right. How's he supposed to fight? It wasn't right, it wasn't right.
tell me now, what's the plan? He came back a broken man, and I was higher than a kite. It wasn't right, it wasn't right. Sad story, now he's gone. Another broken soldier down. Out of mind and out of sight. It wasn't right, it wasn't right. Seventeen, it wasn't right. 18, it wasn't right. They shipped them off, it wasn't right. It wasn't right, it wasn't right. It wasn't right, it wasn't right.
That's a very cool song.
Thank you.
And very simple.
Yeah, simple's good, you know? I think you have to sympathize with the audience sometimes and not try and show everything you know all the time. And I try not to write from a real insecure place, or I try not to be complicated unnecessarily. There were times when I was. And sometimes that's good.
I was going to say, and sometimes that's youth.
Yeah.
You know, as you get older, you realize, nah, we can just edit that right out. Don't need it. Don't need it. And it's a great thing. It's
it really
a great
is.
Thing to get to that point where you say, you know, I can say it with these three chords, and I don't need to add 48 others. But like you said, it also can be fun. You know,
when I was writing with Greg, who's going to be another one of my guests on this show, Greg Kalk, who is obviously a virtuoso on guitar and a funny guy. And as a writer, he goes to some very complex places. And I think the way to deal with that is to you do the simple part then, so there isn't – it isn't complex, and all of a sudden it's complete prog rock of some sort.
You know, and I'm thinking about protest songs, and of course I think about people like Woody Guthrie, and I think about, you know, the great protest songs in the UK over, you know, miner strikes and various things. And there's something about them. They have to be both anthemic in some way. Mm-hmm. There's like that anthem quality, but they have to touch people. I don't write music, but I think it would be really easy to make it too sentimental.
It has to be processed somehow. It has to be a song. It can't just be content. Otherwise, it's an article, you know? It has to find its musical legs, and it has to have something seductive in there to draw you in. And that's tough. Writing protest songs is tough. And, you know, when you're talking about a song like 1913 Massacre by Woody Guthrie, which is heartbreaking, it's still a great song structure.
Billy Bragg is another one who writes some really great, you know, modern protest songs.
Yeah.
Do you think a protest song needs something that the audience can sing along with, or is that not necessary?
I think it always helps. I think it helps. He's amazing. And actually, Semi-Twang is going to do the first night of the convention at Shank Hall, and we're going to do this protest record we're making. The next three nights. I think there's the convention, four nights total.
I think so.
Billy Bragg's there. So that's going to be cool.
Oh, man. Yeah. You're going to be there all three nights, right?
I hope so, yeah.
He's great. I saw him at Turner about a decade ago, and he's just amazing in performance.
Yeah.
He's just, whether you agree with him politically or not, is immaterial. He's just an electrifying performer.
Yeah.
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 And a great songwriter.
No kidding.
Yeah.
And I love that what he did, he and Wilco did with the Woody Guthrie lyrics on Mermaid Avenue. That's one of my favorite records from the 90s. It's in the top five, I think.
Seeger on Songs, you've got the one coming up with David and Holly, and then you've got one with Greg. What's happening after that?
Well, we've got Ramblin' Dino locked in. He's Dean Schlabowski, a Milwaukee native who didn't live here for a long time. He lived in Chicago and Austin, and he's a member of the Waco Brothers, who feature John Langford from the Mekons. And they're punk rockers, but they love country music. And Dino, he's just got the fire right now to write t- topical songs, and he's doing a great job.
Terrific.
I mean, they're funny. He has one called The Racist Barber, which he sings in the first person, a cappella. He's got just a bunch of them, and they're so good, you know? So, you know, it's dangerous to talk about songs, but I think I've been thinking and talking about them forever, and they're still mysterious. You never solve that mystery of why people understand it instantly.
Or why one is really good and one just doesn't quite make it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, what is the magic piece?
And one doesn't quite make it and wins the award at the Oscars.
Right. Yeah, that often happens. Yeah. Well.
It's a weird.
It really is.
It's a weird meritocracy we live in.
Yeah. Well, John, it has been such a pleasure.
Well, thank
having
you
in the studio over the last 14 years in various forms and guises.
We're going to miss you here in Milwaukee. It's going to be diminished. When you leave.
It is a mutual feeling. I am going to miss everybody too. But I'm coming back. I've already told people I'm coming back for Irish Fest.
You should come back for the convention.
No.
You could be the expert.
No. I'm escaping. No, I'll be deep in getting my feet under me in the new job. So
yeah,
big stuff. Dang. But I will be back for Irish Fest, and I plan to come see people. And I've been telling everybody, if you're ever out touring and you're in upstate New York, you let us know. We have a
How
nice
far up is this? How
almost in Canada.
Oh,
so you
wow.
can escape if you need to.
You're lucky because you may have to move there.
I can swim. I can swim across
it's
the St. Lawrence.
It's on the St. Lawrence?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Almost. I mean, it's like 20 minutes from the St. Lawrence.
Oh,
yeah.
It's got to be beautiful up
it's
there.
It's gorgeous up
yeah.
there. Yeah.
Oh,
it
well,
really
congratulations.
Is. Thank you,
you
so much.
You earned it.
Thank you.
And you'll be with our friend Mitch out
our
there,
friend
too.
Mitch, yep.
Yeah.
And a whole bunch of new good people. And it's a great music station as well as news station. So, you know, if you guys end up on tour, let me know.
Yeah, I'm going to do a little trio or quartet for the acoustic stuff. And Semi-Twine could. You never know.
You never know. You just let me know. So
once I get that number one hit,
then you can afford to go. So
okay. Well, I have a song for you.
You do.
To send you off. In style, it's called Remember Me, but We'll Remember You is how it goes. It's kind of a love song, and it's kind of a more universal than that, I hope. Anyway, I'm going to do it for you. Yeah, won't you please remember me when you get down on bended knees to say a prayer? Won't you remember me?
John Seeger hosts Seeger on Songs Conversations at the Jazz Gallery starting tonight. There is a link to ticket information at WUWM.com. Jason Reavy engineered our in-studio session.
The one that you are sweet on when you are frosted, let me turn the heat on. In a ragged state of mind, so worn out in these jagged times, we all need love, won't you remember me?
And thank you so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North, hoping that you'll join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It is 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next.